nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
The title of this segment is NEMO 1D, Importance of New Boundary Conditions. In the previous lectures, I've walked you through the physical effects of these boundary conditions. Now I'm going to make those more relevant by comparing to experimental data to give you an idea how important these boundary conditions are. Again, here's the Mickey Mouse description of an RTD. It's easy to now to understand with the previous lectures how current increases, decreases, and increases again. And again, here's my punchline that these boundary conditions were of utmost importance to ultimately allow us to be predictive before experiment. So here you see a publication typical for 1994 where somebody actually published an IV curve and they didn't even scan it in digitally. They just literally showed a photograph of a CRT. It wasn't untypical at the time. And then they write a layer structure like this where they say, okay, our central RTD is a 5 nanometer device of 40% aluminum, gallium arsenide barriers. And then they have an 18 nanometer gallium arsenide buffer. And then a 200 nanometer low doping buffer, and then a high doping contact. And then you make a little sketch like this, well, that's my double barrier structure. And that looks pretty benign, right? Nothing fancy about it. Until you try to look at the band profile of such a device. This device is roughly 500 nanometers or 450 nanometers long. Okay? 15 nanometers of that is the device you typically care about. And it looks, under bias, quite dramatic. You have very high doping on the left and the right, and that is extremely far away from his central device. And then you see in red these Fermi levels, and in yellow, I think I've shaded here 5 kT, maybe 10 kT, above the Fermi level. You have to ask yourself, how do carriers possibly get through the structure and actually generate an IV curve like that? Right? This is a huge barrier right here in the emitter. How do you model that? Okay? That was a fundamental question on how to go about that. And what these boundary conditions allow you to do is treat a geometry like that. And then you start to look carefully in these devices, and you kind of see a little indentation in that IV curve. It's not a perfectly straight line. There's a little wiggle in here. And from the previous lectures, you start to appreciate that there's something interesting going on, right? Up there, in the emitter, you have a triangular well. And now I'm showing on the bottom left a so-called density of states, where in gray you show points in space and energy where carriers can be. It's a density of states. So you see in the central resonance a ground state and an excited state with two lobes. The excited state is broader than the ground state. And you see three states bound into this notch. You see a ground state, a double lobe, and a triple lobe state. And then you see standing waves sort of bending up against the barrier. What these boundary conditions allow you to do is model the current injection out of these discrete states. And indeed, you find that this little hump you see here on the IV on the bottom is actually coming from coupling of the central resonance to this the excited state in the emitter. And then you can associate the main peak of the IV with tunneling from the ground state in the emitter to the ground state in the resonant tunneling diode. Okay? The way you treat that is, as shown in the previous lectures, that you subdivide your device into a contact region as reservoirs on the left and the right, and you march your boundary conditions in numerically to just model the central device under non-equilibrium. Again, the key message here is that in quantum transport, not only do you have to know where the states are, but on how they are filled. So you have a dynamics equation that tells you where the states are, and a kinetics equation that tells you how they are filled. And that's a slide in principle that I showed in the previous lecture. You discretize your device spatially, you divide it into a left contact, central device, and a right contact. You have boundary conditions that you derive, and you just do non-equilibrium Green functions in the central device domain that reaches from 0 to, say, node n minus 1. And you have these boundary conditions that march in a flat band condition from the far left into the central device and from the far right into the central device. And again, not only do you need to know how the central device is coupled, how electrons can scatter out, you also need to fill in electrons from the left and the right, and that's where these boundary self-energies, sigma less than, are important. And they are determined by the ability to scatter in and out multiplied by the occupation in the left and the right. So you take that imaginary part of the scattering self-energy times F left or times F right, the Fermi level in the left and the right. So here is another example of a really bizarre looking device. This is a resonant tunneling diode based optical switch. There is a window, an optical window that was embedded here on an indium phosphide wafer, and then there's an indium gallium arsenide pre-structure, and then an RTD. And you can see again within this domain of 280 nanometer, the central RTD, that's your critical switch, is just tiny. To make this a little bit clearer, let's zoom in a little bit. This emitter looks really complicated. It's not a trivial emitter. It has, again, I'm showing the density of states. You can see there's a really strange triangular well that looks a little bit far away from the RTD, and then you see a ground state, an excited state, 3 nodes, 4 nodes, 5 nodes in this quantum well, right? These are the ground state and the excited states in a rather complicated potential profile. And then you have a central RTD state of a ground state and an excited state. And even in the zoomed up picture, it seems to be too small. So let's zoom in further, right? You have ground state and a double lobe state. So again, the point is the central RTD looks minuscule in this whole world that is around it that turns out to be important. So what we were able to measure experimentally and theoretically, so measurement is here in blue. You see an IV that has a bunch of steps in it and then it decays down. And then in the simulation we have steps that just pretty much overlap. And we get quantitative agreement in this. There's no way you can do this with flat band boundary conditions in a Mickey Mouse device that are coupled like that. We're getting the currents right, we're getting the details right, we're getting the coupling to the emitter right. And why would you do something like that in another sense? Well, if we are doing reasonably well in these calculations that were done without scattering, but we have scattering in the emitter, that's already incredibly important. But if we wanted to do scattering in the central device, we know that is a very hard thing to do. In non-equilibrium Green functions, to do scattering is computationally incredibly expensive. So you want to reduce the domain in which you do scattering as much as possible to a domain that makes sense. So if we just wanted to do non-equilibrium inside the central device domain, we need to find ways to just look at the central device domain and not do scattering in this huge domain. And basically, if you do scattering calculations that typically scale in the order of n squared or n cubed, where n is the number of nodes in your system, So if you can make n significantly smaller, you will do that. And when I will show later scattering calculations where we've done these for realistic structures, that is what we've done. We've taken the contacts in, treat them in equilibrium, and then we do scattering in just the central domain, and we include phonons, interface roughness, etc. All right. So now let's compare these new boundary conditions to what was the state of the art in 1994. So typically, the choices you had were you computed a bandage diagram and you scratch your head and said, I have no idea how to model that. The things I know how to do in quantum mechanics in these so-called quantum transmitting boundary conditions is to attach boundary conditions for flat bands, because you can analytically know how these states scatter out, right, with scattering boundary conditions. So the two choices you pretty much had is you would attach a flat band way out on the left, or you might make a wild guess and sort of attach them somewhere closer to the central device. But those were the choices that were pretty much pursued. So let's see what happens if you do that. Well, in both choices, you get an IV curve that looks roughly N-shaped, right? It goes up, it goes down, and goes back up. Except the two give dramatically different results. And with the previous lectures that we had on this topic, you kind of understand why. Well, if you inject just from out here on the left, way out on the left in blue, only carriers that are sort of bubbling thermally above this barrier will make it through the structure. So that means if the central resonance in the central RTD comes over or at close to this bump, it's going to shut off because there's no coherent transmission through this channel anymore. So it's going to shut off early. And if you just attach these green flat lines right at the left and the right of the RTD, you know, you're completely omitting the details of this triangular well. So your source of electrons, in a sense, is too large. It's a huge source. And it's going to take a higher voltage to pull the resonance past this very deep bucket of electrons, so to speak. So the IV curve will turn off too late. In fact, if you put your experiment, this is now with a theory, which pretty much overlaps experiment as I've shown before, is you completely are unaware of these wiggles that are due to this coupling in the emitter, and your voltage is off on a logarithmic scale. What you have on the right is a log-log plot, right? This is exponential orders of magnitude that you can be off, right? Your voltage is off by a factor of 20 ballpark, and your current is off by a factor of 20, depending on what boundary conditions you are. That is how far off the state of the art was at the time. All right, so now I made a big deal about these boundary conditions. Okay, so we are getting pretty close to the experimental data. We get the wiggles and the curves. And now you can say, well, Klimek, I mean, this is not even close, right? What's with the valley current? You made the point that we want to understand valley current, but you're not even getting close to the valley current. So let's try to understand that a little bit more. In the previous lectures, we also showed that it's important to look at charge self-consistency, right? So the previous simulations I had shown just the Thomas Fermi potential. And we've shown that charge self-consistency starts to linearize the IV a little bit, and it raises the peak up a little bit. If you include a contact resistance of 2.5 ohms, the whole IV also leans over a little bit, and the peak doesn't change, but you can basically overlap the experiment in terms of peak for this device. But you're still not getting the valley current right. So, valley current is due to scattering, right? That was the state-of-the-art knowledge. So we spent a lot of time putting scattering into NEMO 1D. So let's look at that. Let's explore that. Okay? That's going to be in the next lecture. Do you guys understand roughly the boundary conditions? How they're important now in realistic devices? Because then we'll just move on.